Well, good evening. This is our last week of apologetics. I know I'm sad to see it go, and I hope maybe you are a little too, but I am glad that our pastor is coming back. Tonight, we're going to talk about two topics, tolerance and tactics. Tolerant, today, it's the vogue thing to be. If you're not tolerant, well, you're intolerant, and intolerance is politically incorrect. And it just doesn't play well. If you're in the break room and someone calls you intolerant, you're most likely to stop talking. It's going to shut you down. So before we get too far into this, I want you to think of the definition of tolerance. What does it mean? Come up with that definition in your mind. And then I'm going to ask you two questions. Okay, question time. Now, you have to vote by the raising of your hand. Be committed, okay? The small action is all that's required from you tonight. The first statement, raise your hand if you agree. All views are equally valid. No view is better than another. If you agree, raise your hand. Come on, people, commit. If this is what you believe, raise your hand. Okay. The second statement. It's okay to say hateful things to gays. Any takers? Okay, good. People were paying attention last week. This is good. Well, here's the thing. You all did pretty well. Actually, very well on the whole. If you raised your hand for the first statement, you should have raised your hand for the second statement. Because if all views are equally valid, none is better than another, then it's just as valid to say that gays should be, it's just as valid to say hateful things to gays as it is not to say hateful things to gays. That view is just as valid as any other. Now, I've done this talk at a high school before. And you should have seen the hands go up for the first question, the first statement. Yeah, we agree with that. All views are equally valid. That's actually not tolerance, though. That's what's called the new tolerance. This idea that all views are equally valid, no view is better than another, you can't say anything is wrong. But how does that work? It actually doesn't. Because often adherence to this new tolerance will be very quick to be intolerant of your intolerance. And that just shows that the view doesn't work. Here's another point. You can't tolerate something you agree with. Your wife just cooked you a great dinner. Picture this. Honey, how was that? Oh, I tolerated that. That was great. I've never said that for the record. That's not how that word works, and we know that's not what that word means. You can actually only tolerate things you disagree with. For instance, you're going on a walk and you have a small stone in your shoe. You're going to tolerate that probably until it irritates you enough to do something about it. But you definitely don't like it. It's not just as valid of a view or feeling as not having a rock in your shoe. No, it's irritating. And so this new tolerance is self-defeating. If you have to be accepting of all views, but you can't be accepting of people who disagree with that view, it doesn't work. And if you're not tolerant today, you might be called some names. You might be called a bigot. You might be called mean or narrow-minded or hateful. But this just amounts to name-calling. This is what children do in elementary school on the playground. You stole my toy. You're a mean bully. But adults have taken to doing this too. But this is just a whip to keep you in line. You say something that's politically incorrect, you're a bigot. They just crack the whip, and you're going to step back in line probably. You don't want your coworkers who know you're a Christian probably to think, this person's a bigot and he's a Christian? Wow, I don't want anything to do with that Christianity stuff. So words can powerfully affect us. And people generally start calling names when they're unwilling to have their views challenged on the merits. Because people who have facts on their side will respond with a well-reasoned response. They'll give reasons for the view they possess or why they think you're wrong. But people who don't have reasons on their side are very quick to call names. It's just a tactic to shut you up. It's so much easier to say, you intolerant bigot, than to confront an idea and either refute it or be changed by it. And don't miss that second part. I've spent 8 weeks confidently telling you things I very much believe to be true. But there have been many times in my life when I've gone into a conversation and come out with my mind changed. So be confident in what you believe, but hold your beliefs with somewhat of an open hand. Because when we have a conversation with someone, the goal is not to leave right and the other person wrong. No, the goal is for both people to hopefully arrive at the truth. And you might be able to learn something from that other person. Now, what is tolerance actually? What has it been for hundreds, thousands of years? Well, Webster's dictionary defines the word tolerate as such: to allow or permit, to recognize and respect others' beliefs and practices without sharing them, to bear or put up with something or someone not necessarily liked. Well, that's radically different from this new tolerance. And our postmodern culture has very much corrupted this word and its ideals. Being tolerant, that used to be an ideal, a virtue, something to be ascribed to. But there are three parts about true tolerance that are worth noting. It involves permitting or allowing a conduct or point of view one disagrees with or doesn't like, while respecting the person who disagrees with you in the process. Now let's see how the new tolerance fares against these three criteria. Well, it doesn't permit or allow things it disagrees with. It's very quick to drop the hammer on you. And the second point, conduct one disagrees with. Well, on the other hand, the new tolerance says we shouldn't disagree with anything, which doesn't work. All views are equally valid. And there's generally not much respect from adherents to the new tolerance. The original tolerance was the type of idea where I may disagree with what you have to say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. The new tolerance is more like, I disagree with what you have to say, and I will do everything I can to shut you up, to stop you from sharing it. Those are very different. One respects a person and disagrees with their ideas and acts like an adult in the situation, and another doesn't. All people are valuable, and that's why everyone should be respected. Everyone is worthy of respect, but all ideas are not. Last week, when we talked about homosexuality, I said all people are innately valuable. The heterosexual, the homosexual, everyone. However, all actions are not the same. A handshake is different than a slap to the face. In the same way, ideas are not all the same. You know, getting drunk on the weekend and going mattress sledding behind a truck in the woods is not nearly as good of an idea as doing your homework or reading your Bible or reviewing Wednesday's apologetics lesson. All ideas are not the same. So to say that all views, all ideas are equally valid, George Orwell said, there are some statements that are so stupid that only an intellectual could have thought of them because the common person is far too smart for that. And I think this new tolerance is one of those. But here's how you can handle dealing with people who follow this new tolerance. When you're called intolerant, always ask for a definition. That's very important, and we'll come back to this later in our tactics section. Almost always, when the person defines what they mean by intolerant, they're going to contradict themselves. So here's how this works. John says something in the break room. Bill says, you're intolerant. John says, what do you mean by intolerant? Bill says, well, you think you're right and everyone else is wrong. Well, here's how John could reply. Why is it intolerant when I think I'm right, but when you think you're right, you're just right? You see, Bill is doing the same thing, thinking he's right and everyone else is wrong, that John is doing. And if it's not okay for John, why is it okay for Bill? This is the first step to getting someone to see that this new tolerance doesn't actually work. Now, you'll see that this reply is in the form of a question. And in fact, as I role-played this little dialogue, everything John said was a question. And over our past eight weeks together, I've used questions primarily for my responses to the claims of culture. With abortion last week, pretty much every slide, every issue we looked at had a question as a reply. And there's a reason for that. And this brings us to tactics. Now, you can go into battle and have the biggest gun and lose due to a lack of strategy, a lack of tactics. However, as Christians, we have the big guns. We have truth on our side. But we can still not be as effective as we could be in conversation if we don't have a tactical approach. And so that's a little of what I want to convey to you tonight. In Acts 17, we see, according to Paul's custom, he went to them for three Sabbaths and reasoned with them from the scriptures, explaining and giving evidence that Christ had to suffer and rise from the dead. And some of them were persuaded. There are a few things I want to point out in this passage. Paul was consistent. He went every Sabbath for 3 weeks. There are people you are around constantly, and you should be consistent in sharing with them. Does that mean every day you walk into the office and say, Jesus died for you, you're a sinner? No, it doesn't. It means you can start a conversation in 2014 and little by little talk to that person, give them things to think about, reshape their view over time, and maybe by 2018, that person is primed and ready to hear about how Jesus can offer forgiveness for their sins. That's what this type of approach lends itself to. The bar to entry is extremely low. Some other things to point out here. Paul reasoned with them. He gave evidence. We've spent 8 weeks learning evidence, learning reasons and arguments that you can present to people. And people were persuaded, most importantly. Reason, evidence, it's compelling. Sometimes I think, as we've talked about before, the church tends to just say, well, just have faith. Well, faith in what? They have to know the what. They have to know the truth. And we have to tell it to them because they can't learn it any other way. So questions, that's the way to share. People really like answering questions. People like talking about themselves. So if your conversational approach is asking questions, you're probably going to get quite a ways. Additionally, questions are non-threatening. If you ask someone about their views, well, I want to talk about myself. I want to tell you about my views. But there's another good reason to do it also. People have many different views. I was talking with Joanne earlier, and we were talking about how no two atheists probably have exactly the same views. No two Christians have exactly the same views. So when you meet someone, maybe they're an atheist, don't just assume you know what that person believes because of their label. Ask them. It's warmer, it's more friendly, and it will give you more information in order to actually respond to the person in a way that will be persuasive. And maybe more importantly to some of you, you don't have to know much to ask questions. Someone says something, ask a question about what they said. The bar to entry is very low. All of you, whether you've been here for the last 8 weeks or this is your first night, you should feel more comfortable after this brief tactics lesson getting into conversations with people, because all you have to do is ask questions. You can only go in as far as you're comfortable. So our first question, our first tactic, Columbo. Named after the detective on the detective show, who was kind of an unassuming character, who would ask questions in an confrontational way and was very good at his job. Greg Kokel is an apologist, and he has written a book called Tactics. It's listed on the back of your handout with some other related resources. And these tactics come from his material. Columbo number one, when someone says something, say, what do you mean by that? You're intolerant, John. What do you mean by that? I actually pointed at John. That's kind of funny. What do you mean by that? That's what we just looked at. And that got the conversation moving in an easy way. And John gave us some information. I'm sorry, Bill gave us some information. Well, you think you're right. Well, then we can reply with a question. Our first question, what do you mean by that? This is not just helpful when talking with non-Christians. It's helpful with Christians. It's helpful when you talk with Mormons, who have a lot of the same vocabulary that we do, but mean very different things. The Trinity. What do you mean by the Trinity? Explain that to me. Our second question. How did you come to that conclusion? This gets to the evidence-giving part of the conversation. Someone made a claim. Okay, good. It is not your job to try and refute that claim. If someone says God does not exist, you don't need to say, yes, he does, and start giving evidence. No. You could do that, but the better tactical move is to say, what do you mean by God? Or how did you come to the conclusion that God doesn't exist? Make them prove their case. If someone makes a claim, it's their job to prove it. It's not your job to refute it. Are you starting to see why the barrier to entry is a little lower than you thought? Make them do the talking. You stay in the driver's seat. So how did you come to that conclusion? Here's an example. Evolution is true, someone might say. Well, what do you mean by evolution? Well, change over time, the person might say. Well, I believe in that too. You've gotten taller, you've changed over time. No, not that. I mean, like finches' beaks changing. Is that all you mean? Well, no, I mean that an organism can go from one species to another, from one kind to another. Okay, how did you come to that conclusion? Make them give the evidence. Don't start saying, no, in the Bible and this fossil record. And no. Make them defend their point of view. Not in a harsh way, in a conversational way. Here's another example. It's wrong to force your views on people. You can't legislate morality. You could ask some people, what do you mean by morality? Do you think things are actually right and wrong? I do. Now, there are many different directions you can go with this question. If they say they believe in actual right and wrong, you could use the moral argument for God's existence, which we covered in our morality week when the power was out. And that's a positive way to argue for God's existence from something they've affirmed, that there is actual right and wrong. But a simple question you could ask such a person. Okay, you can't legislate morality. Do you vote? Well, yes, I do. And here's where our third question comes in. Have you considered, that's how we start, have you considered that voting is a way of trying to force your morality on other people? Have you considered that your view that it's wrong to force your morality on people, you're actually forcing that on me right now? Have you considered? It's a way to make a point in a less threatening and offensive way. So, Columbo number one, what do you mean by that? Columbo number two, how did you come to that conclusion? Number three, have you considered? These questions also work great in your marriage. Communication problems abound in friendships, at work, in your marriage, and asking simple, non-threatening questions. You didn't know you were gonna get a marriage lesson tonight, did you? Bonus. It's an easy way to help any conversational relationship. That brings us to our next tactic, suicide. Now, this is not what you do if the conversation doesn't go your way. That's important to understand. No, there are three steps to this tactic. Pay attention and determine the claim a person is making. The way you do that is you say, what do you mean by that? How'd you come to that conclusion? Just like a chess player who has a favorite opening, those should be your two opening questions. And after you determine the claim a person is making, ask yourself, does this claim also apply to itself? And if so, is there a conflict? Because if a claim applies to itself and also contradicts itself, it commits suicide. That's why the tactic's named that way. Here's a simple example. All English sentences are three words long. Okay, what's the claim that's being made? I think we all see that. And two, does the claim apply to itself? Well, yes, it does, because that's an English sentence. Does it contradict itself? It does, because that's an English sentence that's longer than three words. So that claim commits suicide. What you'll see is that Columbo is a great intro to suicide, and from suicide, use Columbo. These are ways of getting people to talk, understanding their point of view, so when you feel comfortable, you can make an assertion, or you can point out where they're wrong. And don't misunderstand, some people are not comfortable with pointing out where other people are wrong. But if someone's not a Christian and they don't see the need for Jesus, they need to understand they're wrong before they understand the need for Christ's forgiveness. You have to show that people are wrong. It's not politically correct. It might not be tolerant. However, it's important. I don't think Paul went around saying, all views are equally valid, but you need Jesus. No. He said, you're wrong, here's why, here are the reasons. It's true, ask other people who are witnesses, and you need Jesus. Some other examples. You shouldn't believe in religion. The Christian would reply, why not? Well, there's no scientific evidence for it. Well, have you considered that there's no scientific evidence for science, too, that we should trust? Have you considered that if you use science to prove science, that's a circular argument? You can't use something to prove itself? The Christian might make a claim, which, if you make a claim, you need to be prepared to back it up. You might say homosexuality is wrong. And a person might reply, you shouldn't criticize other people. Well, have you considered that by saying that you're actually criticizing me right now? Now, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. We can disagree. But you understand that your viewpoint is inconsistent. Or everything is predetermined. Well, does that include your actions? Yes. So, if you don't have any choice in what you say, why should I believe what you say? If you're just a robot, why would I put stock in the ideas that you're putting forth? And then science. Only science can give us truth. Is that a scientific truth? You could also say, what do you mean by science, using our first Columbo question? And the person could say, yes. You could say, how did you come to that conclusion that only science can give us truth? Or to get a little more to the point, have you considered that you couldn't actually do a lab experiment to show that science is the only source of truth? In order to do science, you need logic, which is not scientific. You need morality to accurately report your results. It's also not scientific. Have you considered these things? There are many other tactics. There are tactics for dealing with steamrollers, people who just want to push through the conversation and won't let you get a word in edgewise. There's a tactic called taking the roof off, and it's actually one I used almost exclusively last week when we talked about abortion. It involves seeing where a person's viewpoint actually leads and showing it to them. For instance, with abortion, we should be allowed to kill the unborn because it's too small, someone might say. Well, okay, what's that principle? We can kill things because they're small. Can we kill the toddler? No. Well, some other people say we can kill the unborn because it's not as developed. Once again, do we get to kill the toddler? No. This is an example of suicide, and in fact, almost every point last week, I'm sorry, that's an example of taking the roof off. Last week, almost every point, I responded with some form of taking the roof off. Greg Kokel's book on the back, Tactics, appropriately named, goes into these and about four other tactics. And you can take what you've learned these last 8 weeks, even if you haven't been here, and you just came tonight, you can take that book. It's only 200 pages, 61,000 words. He has a very easy writing style. And you can get much more equipped to talk with your friends, your relatives, your coworkers, and make a persuasive impact for the kingdom. Some conclusions. Use tactics to show the new tolerance doesn't work. Use questions. One bonus I want to leave you with that I'd forgotten to mention earlier. Let's go back to Bill and John in the workroom. Let's say the TV's on and there's a news story. It's about Christians and their thoughts on same-sex marriage. And Bill, the non-Christian, says to John, hey, John, I know you're a Christian. What are your thoughts about that? It's the break room. It's lunchtime. John's in the hot seat. He doesn't want to come across as a bigot. He doesn't want to be labeled intolerant or narrow-minded. But he also faithfully wants to represent what the Bible says and what Christ believes and teaches. So what does he do? Here's what he does. Bill, can I ask you a question? Yeah. Do you consider yourself to be a tolerant person? Are you accepting of other people's views even if you disagree with them? Well, yeah, Bill's going to say yes. He doesn't want to seem intolerant in front of the lunch crowd. Okay, I just wanted to check. I wanted to see if it's safe to share how I believe here. And then John can go ahead and say, not necessarily an argument from the Bible. He could say, you know, I think same-sex marriage isn't good for society. I think that the government is involved in promoting heterosexual marriage because as a group and by nature, it provides for the next generation. It stabilizes society. It literally brings forth children and supports them. And that's something homosexual unions can't do. Now, what happens if Bill gets upset at John? Oh my gosh, I can't believe you believe that way. Well, Bill, I thought you said you were accepting of other people's ideas. I thought you were a tolerant person. I might be missing something, but I'm not feeling that right now. Hold people to what they say. Use questions. Use tactics. Get the book. It's great. So, this new tolerance that you have to be accepting of all views, it doesn't actually work. You can't apply it. And people do not apply it consistently either. The tactics we learned, Columbo 1, 2, and suicide. What do you mean by that? How'd you come to that conclusion? Have you considered? And then the suicide tactic. Identify points that contradict themselves. Well, that's our lesson tonight. It's very short because we have a Q&A now. So hopefully you've been thinking about your questions for a week, and there's a microphone on each side. And I may not have the answer to your question, but I will give it my best. And whoever goes first should have an easy question, just to get things warmed up. And so, whoever wants to go first, go ahead. Well, by an easy question, I mean one I know the answer to. John.
Hi, I'm John. And the question I have is, how long have animals been around?
Oh boy. Okay, that's a good question. So that's something that I think you were out of town on the week we talked about that a little. So you should go online to briansegraves.com or the church website and check out that lesson. So the short answer, we didn't get much into the fossil record. I did say there's good evidence that the Earth is young, and there is fossil evidence that can be interpreted that way. And I also said there's good evidence that the Earth is old, and there's evidence that can be interpreted that way. And you've got each side with different interpretations of the evidence. Some have evidence that fit their view and totally discount the other. And it's complicated. It's convoluted. And the other thing I mentioned at the beginning of that lesson was it's very possible that everything is very young, thousands of years. And God created everything with the appearance of age, with the appearance of billions of years. If he did, we could never know for sure. I do think the fossil record shows that life is millions of years old. And what we actually see, some slides we skipped over, deal with a period of time called the Cambrian era and something called the Cambrian explosion, which we get pretty much all 20 phyla types of organisms that exist today within 50 to 60 million years. That's so much new genetic information being brought into existence that evolution can't account for it. So it's a powerful argument for creation, for God doing that work. And so my personal belief, not something we should argue about, is that life is old. However, it's very possible that it's young. So not to waffle on that, but does that answer your question? Okay. Yes, sir.
I'm Chet, and thank you very much for this series. It's been very rewarding. Brian, when I heard your lecture about the varying types and kinds of Bibles and the eye-popping differences among the translations, I got very uncomfortable in my reliance and all for all these years on the NIV.
Okay.
And please tell us, if you can, what's the best one, the most reliable one, or ones that you select and recommend for our use?
Okay. Will do. Yeah, there were a few people that had similar comments. First, a bias, I work for a company that makes a Bible translation. It's called the New English Translation. And Chet, it's the best one. So a little bit about that. There's a book on the back of your handout called How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth. And one of the first things it deals with is choosing a Bible translation. And so I would recommend that book. It deals with many other topics, but that's a good one. A lot of times we pick a Bible translation because we like how it reads, and we don't know why it reads that way. And so I would encourage all of you, no matter which translation you're currently using, find out what the translation philosophy was. Find out how they decided to translate he's and she's. Did they make a he become a them to make it gender neutral? And that's one of the things the new NIV has done. And that's why there's been a lot of pushback against it. Because when you take a he and you make it a them, you've taken a singular and made it a plural. And that's getting to changing the meaning. That's getting to changing how the text reads. The other thing I would say is I wouldn't use just one translation. If I'm trying to understand what the original intent was, I'm going to use two. I might use an NIV, something that's more, as we said, dynamically equivalent. So it's more of a phrase-by-phrase translation, which is a very good way to translate. And I might also use something like the New American Standard Bible, the NASB. And so I've got two, not separate ends, not opposing, but two different translation philosophies. One that's more formal and wooden. And so if the Greek said God's nostrils enlarged, the NASB might say that. But the NIV or the NET or the ESV might say God became angry. And so you're going to get a better picture. The other benefit to using two translations is when one uses a word, the other one will probably use a different word, but one that's synonymous. And so you get a better concept of the usage of that word, of what's actually being talked about. It's called semantic range. So if I had to recommend a translation, just one, I would recommend the New English Translation or the ESV. But whenever you're studying, I would use two. Next question.
I got one.
Well, after Felsie goes, if you could come up to the mic just so everyone can hear you, that would be great.
Hey, Brian. I just want to thank you again for the excellent study. I truly enjoyed the study.
You're very welcome.
My question is, why should faith in God contradict science? Like early times, scientists like Isaac Newton and Pascal, Kelvin, they were all great believers in God, and science used to be a validation tool for the existence of God. At what point did science and faith in God start to contradict each other?
Okay, that's a really good question. Well, first, what I would want to point out is what do you mean by science? And there, I know what she means, but that's, if someone says that to you, you need to ask that, because there are two definitions for science, and people bring them together when they shouldn't. The first, science is a naturalistic process that can tell us about the natural world. So the scientific method that our kids learn in school, that and related principles, they're the best way we have to learn about this world that God created. But the second definition of science, the one that you're probably getting to, is scientism. And this is almost a religion. It's science says this, but science doesn't talk, scientists do. And so maybe the real question is, at what point did scientists start not being on the theism side, but instead on the maybe atheism side? I think that's been happening progressively more and more since maybe around the Middle Ages, since Newton's time. But the thing I would want to point out is I would disagree that science itself, that first definition, that process, and the information gained from it, I would disagree that that disproves God's existence. I think the more we learn, and some people, some scientists, are actually agreeing with this, people who aren't Christians, the more we learn, the more it points to there being a first cause. So recently, within the last few months, we had the discovery of gravity waves that are remnants of the initial creation of everything. There was a theory that they existed. We finally measured them. And now non-Christians are saying, wow, what created everything? And logically, like we covered when we talked about God and the argument for his existence, it can't have been a thing, because it had to exist before everything. So the cause of all the material world had to be something that's not material. That starts to sound a lot like God. Now, some people, due to their commitment to naturalism, their unwillingness to admit that someone's more powerful than them, they won't admit that. But I do think that our scientific discoveries and evidence do point to the existence of God. The cosmological argument, the expansion of the universe, those are things we can use when people bring up the science card and say science disproves religion. And I think ultimately, it's become more popular to not believe in God, and I don't think it should surprise us that society continues to sink to lower levels when society in general is not saved and doesn't have Christ, and they have a sin nature. So why would we be surprised when they don't want to acknowledge that there's a God? And so that's where good arguments, good information, good reasons come in to show them that it's actually a rational choice to believe in there being a creator God. Does that answer your question? Someone had a question in the middle back here. If you could come to the mic if you're able.
I've had ongoing conversations with Catholic relatives, and they think that I'm in a cult, a Baptist cult. How do I address that?
I'd say it's a good group. You should join. Don't walk away. What do they mean by that? Why do they think it's a cult?
I guess their religion has told them that Baptists are a cult.
In recent years, I would say over the last 10, and maybe this is just because I've become more sensitized to it as I've gotten older, it does seem like Baptists, by the media and by culture at large, are being put in a more extreme category as time goes on. So we're less mainstream. Oh, Baptists? That has a connotation that most other religions don't. I would say there are quite a few differences from Catholicism. Different popes have said comments like, the atheist who acknowledges God in his actions by trying to live a good life, even if he doesn't think God exists, he's covered by Jesus' blood. Well, that's very different than the gospel preached at this Baptist church and other Baptist churches. And so I would say there is a big difference. Our church has seen when we've gone to Cuba, the priest on the island has said, just include Jesus with your other faith tradition. Well, that sounds more like a cult to me, and less like there's one God and he's jealous. And so I don't know that it's bad that people see us as being different or in our own group, but I wouldn't want them to dismiss us because of that. And so whenever people make a claim like that, and it might be easier with Catholics because we generally agree on the same Bible more than other people, I would go back to the text and say, what beliefs of mine put me in a cult, and where in Scripture does it say that my beliefs are wrong? You know, which verses contradict my beliefs? Or show the reasons for why you have your beliefs. And see, go back to the evidence and see if they can contradict it there. Does that help? Other questions? You're the one who asked, what do you mean by that?
That's right. Brian, you referred to the fossil record.
Yes, sir.
Does the flood account for much of the fossil record?
That's a good question. So, what we do see is we've got fossils on tops of mountains and things like that. And so, young Earth creationists would point to that being evidence for a young Earth, for a flood that covered the whole Earth. So there is evidence that can be interpreted that way. You could also say that in billions of years, mountains have come out of the ground, and so they're used to be on ocean floors and this type of thing. I know there are lots of questions about the fossil record, the age of the Earth, and the intellectual side of me finds it very interesting. But the more I get into it, the more uncertain I am, and the more certain I am that it shouldn't be a dividing line. So I don't think that's much of an answer to your question, I'll be honest about that, but there's evidence that goes both ways, and it really comes down to how do you interpret it. So I have a question that was submitted on a note card, so I will read it and then continue thinking of your questions. The attorney I work for always talked about abortion not killing a baby because it hadn't reached the quick. This was the legal term which allowed a lawsuit under our laws. Do you know when this was passed or why? I have had to argue on a Christian law level against that. Well, I actually don't know when that came about in history. But there are some ways that I think we could argue using the law as a precedent that the unborn is an actual life. In the Hebrew day, in the Hebrew law, if two people were fighting, and in their midst of their fighting, they hit a pregnant woman, and her baby died, or she had a miscarriage, it's a little unclear what the word actually translates to, there was justice to be done. Those two people were going to be punished. And even today, we see that a crime that kills a mother and her unborn child, that's a double homicide, or it's double manslaughter. And so I think the law is extremely confused on this issue. So a woman can be on the way to an abortion clinic, get run into by a drunk driver, and it's a double homicide. But she was on her way to kill the baby. So if a medical professional does it, it's somehow okay. But if anyone else does it, it's not. And I think that points from a legal perspective to the law in some ways recognizing that the unborn is an actual human life, that it needs protecting. So I hope that answers your question. It's a little off the topic, but I think it would be helpful. Other questions?
My name is Jason. my question has already kind of been answered on the back of your sheet there. I asked Brian in the week, if he would be willing to share kind of how he came to these conclusions. And so my question is, what can you tell us about your journey and how you developed this hunger and passion to know more, and in what ways can we implement that in our own lives so that we become better ambassadors for Christ?
Definitely. Well, I shared a little about this our first week when we talked about doubts, and I said that there was a time in my life when I was at college that I had amassed more questions than I had answers for, and I didn't think there were answers, or at least good ones, and so I was doubting that God existed. I was doubting that if he existed, he was actually good, and I was doubting that the Bible was true, and I lived in that tension for a couple years. I taught a small group. I played at church when, you know, I was in town, and the whole time, this conflict was eating me up, and I finally got to the point where I still hadn't told anyone, but I knew I needed to find out what the truth was. And so I read Dawkins, and I read Hitchens, and I read Christians, too, and I looked at the evidence, and I became convinced that Christianity was true, not because a pastor had told it to me every Sunday for my, you know, childhood and adolescence, but because I had seen the evidence and I had analyzed it. And whether I liked it or not, it was so much of a better explanation than atheism or some other religion. And I really think it takes more faith to be an atheist than a Christian as a result of that journey. So what did that journey look like? I mentioned I read some books. I do think you should read books of people that disagree with you. The God Delusion, it's a book that for some people has wrecked their faith. But for some people, it's made it much stronger. Read people that disagree with you. Read people, the authors that are on the back of your handout. That's definitely not an exhaustive list of books. It's a sampling that pretty much covers the topics we've talked about this summer. So if you want to go into more detail, they're there. I don't have a formal training in theology. I have not gone to seminary. But what I have done is many hours a week, listened, read, watched teachers. One of the individuals on the back of your handout, Dr. William Lane Craig, he teaches us and is on staff at many different seminaries. And he is probably the foremost Christian philosopher who can go into debates with people and leave having convinced people that Christianity is the reasonable choice. His Sunday school class is probably not what you think of when you think of a Sunday school class, but it's about a 2-year journey through all of Christian doctrine and theology with an apologetics emphasis. There are questions and answers, and there's a link to that on there. It's called the Defenders class. I've gone through that. I've listened to apologist Greg Kokel I've listened to about 10 years of his material. I went back and listened. It's 3 hours a week. I've read many books, as much as I can get my hands on. And so it's actually kind of amusing sometimes when people say, have you listened to Ravi Zacharias? I got that question about 10 times a week coming up to this study. No, I haven't. I think he's great from what I've heard. There are so many good teachers out there. You might find some that are not on the back of my list. That list is simply the people that have been helpful to me. And I think it comes down to we have to want either for ourselves to know that our beliefs are true. We've got to want it bad enough. Or we've got to want to know enough so we can share it with other people. So I don't know what to tell you except that Christianity is true and there are great reasons. And so if you can light a fire under yourself, maybe hold each other accountable, then that's something I would do. And if we could put the iPad back up on the screen, there's one slide I'd like to show. So if you want to continue in apologetics or this type of thing, the church, and particularly Nathan Dunn, is going to be putting on the Truth Project. It's an interactive DVD-based Christian worldview series, and it's going to start at 4 p.m. on September 7th. You can check your bulletin for updates or go to thetruthproject.org. I haven't been through it, but that's another one of those things that people have asked me about, and I've heard great things. Some people in this church have been through it 4 times, so that's a great endorsement. The other thing I would say, if you want to go deeper into this, besides the resources listed, I would be more than happy to come to your Sunday school class if you're interested in going into more depth on a topic or having a discussion. So there are lots of resources out there. Those people on the back there have so much material out for free. And if you actually go to my website, there's a version of that list with links to all the books on Amazon. So it's really easy. Any other questions? And we'll bring it to a close shortly. Okay. Yes. Take two.
If we have questions in the future, can we email you?
Definitely. Yeah, I'd be glad. I love talking about these things, if you haven't noticed. So I'd be glad to talk with you. I must say, you all have been extremely encouraging to me. The support has been wonderful. I didn't really know what to expect, but people came. They came in the dark, and that was very encouraging. So I'm very thankful for a church that has such a warm heart. And it's not just me that has noticed that, but others have too. And so I think that's a great testimony to you all. And so let's pray, and we'll be dismissed.